It's a story I think I've told before, so I apologize if it sounds familiar. If you feel like you're having a sense of deja vu, you have perhaps heard this before, but I feel like it's relevant, so I'm going to tell it again. For our very first date, I took Beth to the Disney movie Beauty and the Beast. Only that's not exactly true, because it was our second date, and she didn't know it was a date. We were in college at the time, at UNI, and both Beth and I were a part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And one night at IVF, some of the girls were talking about this new Disney movie, and Beth mentioned how she wanted to see it, but she didn't have a car to get to the mall. I had a car. So I said maybe I could take her. Now, this is an often debated part of Muhlenberg family lore. Beth claims that she thought I was inviting all of the girls to ride along to the movie. I'm pretty sure I made it clear I was only interested in taking her. Either way, she agreed, and we decided to go on Saturday. Now, it just happened that there was a home football game that Saturday, and as you can probably guess, I don't like to miss football games. Beth and I had been to a few games together before with the whole InterVarsity group, and so I suggested to her that before we went to the movie, perhaps we could go to the game together as well. And she agreed. Now, it just happened that my brother and his wife had just had a baby girl, my first niece, and so I mentioned this to Beth, and I said, maybe you could go with me to the University Book and Supply before the game, before the movie, and we could pick out a baby gift for my niece, Amanda. And she agreed. And it just so happened that it was an election year. And one of our senators was going to be in the student union that day at about noon. And I'd heard Beth mention before that she was sort of interested in politics. So I suggested that maybe before we went to pick out a gift for my niece, before we went to the football game, before we went to the movie, we could go and we could listen to this senator together. And she agreed. Now, at this point, I was feeling pretty good about things. I had lined up a date that was going to take at least 10 hours. She claims she still didn't know it was a date. As it happened, it snowed on the big day. And I don't mean just a little snow. There was a full-on blizzard. But I didn't let that stop me. I trudged across campus to Beth's dorm. Together, we walked out to check on the condition of the car. It was obvious we weren't going anywhere in the car. They canceled the senator's speech, but we still made it over to the University Book and Supply. Got a nice little UNI onesie for my niece. They still had the football game, thank you, Unidome, and I think we had a pretty good time. And since I couldn't take her to see Beauty and the Beast like I had promised, I suggested that maybe we could go to the matinee on Sunday afternoon. And she agreed. And that was our second date. Today, we're starting a series on love and marriage. Every fall, we try to do a series that has something to do with family. And as I was planning out the sermons for this year, I really felt like this year I should do something that would emphasize marriage, but I wasn't sure what angle I would take. And then we got an email here at church about this new movie called The Song. And it was a project that involved Pastor Kyle Eidelman and City on the Hill Productions. And both Pastor Eidelman and City on the Hill are things I've been impressed with in the past. I knew they did good stuff. In July, Beth and I had the opportunity to go to Omaha and see this movie and preview it, and we thought it was very good. So we're building this series, the six-week series, around the small group material that goes with this movie, The Song. And, of course, Arv mentioned the movie is playing in Spencer right now, and if you haven't seen it yet, we encourage you to go see it today or sometime this week. Now, I realize that this series on marriage meets all of us at different places. Some of you have been married a really long time, and you could come up here and you could talk about marriage a lot better than I can. Some of you have been divorced, and for some of you, it's been a really hard path, and you could probably come up here and you could give some truths about marriage that I've never considered. Some of you are widowed, and some of you are single. Some of you are way too young to even think about getting married yet. And for those of us who are married, I realize this meets us, you know, all over the spectrum. Some of us might be here and our marriages are going really, really well and it doesn't feel like it could be any better. Some of us maybe are here and it feels like our marriages are on life support. Most of us who are married, I'm guessing, are somewhere in between those two poles on the spectrum. But marriage is a big part of life, just of society, of our community. It's an important thing in our culture. It's an important thing in our community. It's an important thing here in our church. And so whether you're currently married or not, we all have a stake in seeing marriages that thrive and honor God. Marriage is God's idea. He created it. It's important that we let God speak into it and about it. And so I'm hoping you'll dive into this with us. I'm hoping you'll make it a priority to try to be here the next 6 weeks. I'm hoping you'll get into a small group. I'm hoping you'll go and see this movie. So today we're going to start this series on marriage, and we're going to start with attraction. What is it that attracts one person to another? I mean, you know, think of Beth falling in love with me as I drag her through this blizzard. Think of Ryan and Marley's eyes meeting over a pile of Jenga blocks down in the church basement. What is it that attracts one person to another? And to guide us in this, we're going to turn to one of the more mysterious books in the Bible, the Song of Songs. There's actually quite a bit of controversy around this book, beginning with what to call it. The NIV, the New International Version of the Bible, which we're using, calls it the Song of Songs. You may have grown up with it being called the Song of Solomon. Some translations of the Bible call it Canticles, which is Latin for song. The title comes from the very first verse, which reads like this. It's Solomon's Song of Songs. And what that means, basically, is this is the best of songs. It's supposed to be the best of songs, and either it's by Solomon, or it's written for Solomon, or it's written about Solomon. The Hebrew works either way, or any of those three ways. Traditionally, this book has been understood as a love poem written by Solomon about the one girl he truly loved. Now, if you know much about Solomon, you realize he had 700 wives, 300 concubines. So it may seem a little odd that the Bible's go-to book for love and marriage is about or written by a guy who really didn't do that well with marriage. But perhaps you know, maybe that makes sense. If you really want to know about marriage, you should go to the guy who made every mistake in the book. So it's possible that this is Solomon writing about the one girl he truly loved before he kind of, his life did a U-turn, and he went, if you know the book of Ecclesiastes, and all of the mistakes he made that he talks about in Ecclesiastes, this, if it is written by Solomon, this would be written before all of that. But I also read an interesting interpretation of the book this week that suggests maybe it's not by Solomon, but rather about Solomon. This understanding suggests that there are not two main characters in the book, but there are actually three. That there's Solomon, the beloved, the girl, and a third character we would call the shepherd. And under this interpretation, what's happening is Solomon is trying to win the heart of this girl, but her heart actually belongs to this shepherd boy. And if that's the case, and it could be, if that's the case, then she resists Solomon's advances. Here's the king with all of his wealth and all of his prestige and all of his power. But rather than go with him, which would have been the easy thing to do, she stays with this shepherd because of true love, because she would rather sacrifice wealth, and this is actually said in chapter 8, she'd rather give up all of the wealth in the world for true love. If that's the case, then this is about the one girl who got away from Solomon. And either way, whether it's Solomon who's the lover who's writing about the beloved, or if it's really more of a story about this girl and this shepherd, either way, this book is a highly stylized, poetic expression of love that holds out fidelity and romance and passion as wonderful God-given gifts. It's also a book about intimacy. It uses some pretty frank, unblushing language. It's a PG-13 book. In fact, I read this week that rabbis used to say that no Jew should read the Song of Songs until they had attained the age of at least 30. So it's a PG-30 book. It's one of the reasons next week, as you see in the bulletin, we're offering an alternative children's service, because we're going to talk about some of the grown-up stuff that's in this book. Some of the language of this book is pretty forward, and I think it's good to know that the Bible does not isolate our sexuality from God. sex is God's idea. He invented it. And this modern tendency that we have to kind of, you know, reduce sex to something that's purely physical, something that's purely biological and doesn't really, you know, affect who we are on the inside, I think that's not a sophisticated thing that we've gotten to. I think we're actually going backwards. It's a sign of our spiritual poverty that we're taking this very important part of God's creation. We're trying to isolate it from God. The Bible doesn't do that. So, there's no easily defined storyline in this book. It's mostly dialogue between the girl and the man, the beloved and her lover. In a way, it just sort of holds this single romance up like a precious gem and looks at it, you know, from different angles to capture the beauty of it. We won't go verse by verse through this book, but I'll pull out certain verses that will help us understand God's perspective on love and marriage. And as I said, we're going to begin with attraction. What is it that makes one person desirable to another? If you're single and you're thinking you might marry someday, then this sermon is about what you should be looking for in a potential mate. And if you're married, then hopefully this will be a reminder of what it is that draw the two of you together in the first place. I would like to suggest that attraction comes on three tiers, three levels. So tier one is physical. In most cases, attraction between a man and a woman begins at the physical or outward level. We see something we like and we want to see more of it. And let me say right off the bat, physical attraction is okay. It's part of God's design. Look at the second verse of this book. This is the girl talking about the man she's attracted to. Here's what she says. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. It's a really good verse. I've encouraged Beth to memorize this verse in six different versions of the Bible. It's a good verse. I want her to say that a lot. And this is how the whole book starts. Clearly, this woman feels physical attraction towards this man. She finds him utterly intoxicating. He's better than wine. She wants to kiss him later. Verse 16, she says, "How handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming." Beth says that all the time. She likes the way he looks. She likes his charm. She likes his smile. She likes his sense of humor. And what about him? What does he think about the way she looks? Well, he kind of likes what he sees. Here's what he says about her, verses 9 through 11. He says, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh." He says, "Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make earrings of gold studded with silver." Now, obviously, we have to make a few cultural allowances here. I don't think I'd get away with comparing Beth to a horse. But trust me, this guy means this as a compliment. He does. He really does. He's, you know, think about what kind of horse are you going to hitch to Pharaoh's chariot? Right? He's Pharaoh. He's the king of Egypt. You're getting nothing but the finest horse, the most attractive, well-groomed horse with, you know, beautifully the reins and the harness and everything is going to be embroidered with gold and tassels and that sort of thing. And he looks at this girl and he says, "Hey, you're like a fine piece of horse flesh." That's what he says. And he means it. It's good. There's several other references to the woman's physical beauty you're going to find in this book. They're going to sound funny. Strange, even funny. At one point, he compares her hair to a flock of goats coming down a hill. And later, he compares her teeth to a flock of sheep that have been just had their wool shorn. He talks about her temples looking like the halves of a pomegranate. All of which, apparently, was very smooth back in Solomon's day. The point here is that there is a celebration of physical beauty. It's part of the attraction between the two. And what I want to say again is, that's okay. That's part of the way God designed things. In fact, you look at verses 10 and 11 here, and you see that she's dressing up. She's putting earrings on. She's putting necklaces around her throat. And I think what this is saying is that's okay too. You know, to pay attention to what you look like, to get your hair done, to wear nice clothes, to try to take a few extra pounds off so you look good to your mate is acceptable. And in fact, it's biblical. But And there's a huge caution here, but far too much of attraction in our culture stops right here. With the physical. With the outward. What does he look like? How much money does he have? You know, who's she connected to? How does she compare to the girls that we see in the magazines? Proverbs 31 verse 30 says this. It says, "Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised." Here's the thing about the physical. Two things about the physical. It's deceptive and it's declining. Okay, beauty can be deceptive because it doesn't really tell us much about who a person really is. It's superficial. It's just surface stuff. See, I see warrant in Song of Songs for hanging earrings from your ear and doing your hair and that sort of thing. But one of the great crimes of our culture, and it's a crime we're committing against women in particular, is that we're telling people that their self-worth should be measured by how they look. We're putting far too much pressure on women, and especially on our little girls, to live up to certain subjective standards of fashion and beauty. And that's why the New Testament so clearly warns that true beauty does not come from your hairstyle or your jewelry or the clothes that you're wearing. It comes from the inside. So understand this. Physical appearance is a part of attraction, and it's a part of God's design, but it can be deceptive. And second, it's declining. You know this, it doesn't last. Those outward things, those superficial things that make such strong first impressions, for the most part, they don't last. The guy has a lot of money, great, but he might not always have it. That skin, you know, her skin is so smooth and it's flawless. Well, you know, someday it's going to wrinkle. And so if your attraction is based entirely on what you can see, eventually understand that that's going to change. So we need to think about the second tier of attraction. If the first level is physical, the second tier, which is more important, I'll call the moral. More than what the other person looks like, you should be investigating his or her character, what's on the inside. What is this other person really like? Let's go back to Song of Songs here, verse 3. This is what the woman says. She says, "Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you." Okay, in that culture, regular bathing was not a high priority. They didn't bathe often. So what they did to take care of their personal hygiene was they used a lot of perfumes. There was a lot of application of actually olive oil that they would put in their hair and it would make them smell nice. At least what they thought smelled nice. And what she's saying about her man here is that his name is like perfume poured out. And what she's saying is he's got a good name. He's got a good reputation. She says the maidens love him, not just because he's handsome, but because he's a good man. Because he's virtuous. He's got integrity. He's got character. Some translations read, "Your name is like purified oil." And the purified oil was always the first pressing of oil from the harvest. It was the oil that would be used in the lampstand that burned in the temple. In other words, that purified oil was the finest. It was the best. And she says, "Your name, your character, your integrity, it goes before you. It's the best." And what about her? What was her character like? Well, we get a glimpse of that in verses 5 and 6. She says this about herself. She says, "Dark I am, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I'm dark, but because I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me take care of the vineyard, so my own vineyard I've neglected." There's a hint of a tragic Cinderella-like backstory here. In that culture, fair skin was considered beautiful. The fairer, the paler the skin of a woman, the more beautiful she was considered, because fair skin was a sign of power, wealth, prestige. Because if you had servants, then you could sit in the shade of your tent. Well, the servants did the real work, right? And so the paler your skin, the more beautiful you were considered. And this woman has a tan. She's been working in the sun. apparently her father is no longer in the picture, and so she lives with her mother and her mother's sons. She's got stepbrothers, and they're treating her kind of like Cinderella. They're making her go out and work in the vineyard. She has to do all of the work. So that's about all we get for detail about who she was, but there seems to be some sort of tragic backstory behind all of this. But what it tells us about her character is she knows how to work. She's not afraid to get her fingernails dirty. She's not a spoiled princess. It reminds me of another story in the Bible about Isaac's wife. We spent the summer talking about Abraham and Isaac, the child of promise. Well, as Abraham grew older, it came time for Isaac to find a wife. Abraham didn't want Isaac to marry any of the women from the tribes that surrounded them in Canaan. He didn't want Isaac to be marrying with those pagan worshipers. So he sent his steward, his servant, back to the homeland, back to Haran, back to Ur, to find someone from his extended family that Isaac could marry. So this guy goes on this 500-mile journey. When he gets there, it's his job to find a woman that's suitable for Isaac to marry. So what does he do? Well, he doesn't hold a beauty pageant. He doesn't line up all the eligible girls to kind of see what they look like. He doesn't interview them to see if they pass some sort of test. He doesn't set up a website and have a dating profile, that sort of thing. No, what the guy does is when he gets to town is he parks at the town well. And then he prays and he says, God, as I sit here by the town well, let one of these young women come and offer to water my camels. And then he waits to see what will happen. Several young ladies come out and they offer him a drink and whatever, and then they go back with their water. And then one woman comes out. Her name is Rebecca. And he asks her if he can have a drink. And she draws some water and lets him drink. And then she looks around and she says, hey, I could water your camels too. And now, he's got 10 camels. And camels can drink up to 30 gallons of water apiece. So that's a lot of water. Like 300 gallons of water that this woman is going to pull up out of the ground and pour into the trough so that his camels can drink. In other words, this woman, she's a servant. She sees need, she's hospitable, she's not afraid to do some hard work, and the man says, that's the one for Isaac. He was looking, the whole thing was set up to test her character, to see if she had a servant's heart. If you are in a place where you're looking for a potential mate, don't settle for just the external stuff. Put yourself in a position where you can learn about their morals, about their character. How does this person act in stressful situations? You know, are they good at telling the truth? Or is there dishonesty in there? What sort of work ethic does this person have? What sort of temper does this person have? What's their reputation like with other people? I remember one of the first things that attracted me to Beth, before the whole Beauty and the Beast thing. We were at a retreat at church, and we ended up being randomly put in a small group, and Beth shared a story of something really hard she had to go through in high school. And I just remember she told this story. I remember being impressed with her compassion and with her gentleness and with her kindness and her perseverance in what was really a hard situation. It's because of that conversation I wanted to be the one who took her to that movie. Sometimes I see couples who enter into a relationship even though there are some obvious concerns about character flaws in the other person. The one will say something to me like, yeah, I know it's been a problem in the past, but I'm sure it'll change once we marry. I hate to tell you this, but very rarely does that happen. So if you see character flaws, I mean, pay attention. You're looking for someone whose name is like perfume poured out, someone whose reputation is strong with other people. One more thing on this topic. What about intimacy before marriage? Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 7 says this, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles, by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Every interpreter I looked at reads this as a caution against intimacy before marriage. Do not awaken love until it is time. It's so important, in fact, that this same verse is repeated word for word one chapter later, chapter 3, verse 5. I know this is an old-fashioned position. I know it's pretty much assumed that after the second or third or fourth date, especially if you're, you know, in your 20s, that the relationship is going to become physical. But there's a lot of wisdom in waiting. Not the least of which is it says so much about the character of the person you're with. Are they okay with that? Are they okay when you say, well, I want to wait? And if they're not, if the relationship, if you're afraid the relationship is going to fall apart unless you allow it to go to that next physical level, well, then you're not really at tier two, are you? You're still stuck at tier one where it's just about the physical. So there's real wisdom in waiting. So attraction comes on two tiers. There's the physical, and then more important is the moral. But there's a third tier, and in my opinion, this is the most important tier, and I'm going to call it the spiritual. If you are a follower of Christ, then the big question to consider when considering a potential mate is this: what is his or her relationship with Jesus? To be honest with you, there isn't all that much about God in the Song of Songs. His name doesn't really come up. But it is understood that this whole book is written in the context of God's kingdom, that this is God's perspective on love and romance. And we get a hint of that in the last verse of chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 17 says this: the beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are firs. Now, commentators are divided on this, but I'm pretty sure there's a reference to God here. You see, this book was written at the same time that Solomon was building the temple. And you can read about the building of the temple in like 2 Chronicles chapters 2 and 3 and in 2 Kings. And if you go back and you read about the building of the temple, one of the things that's going to stand out to you is that the wood they used when they built the temple was cedar. Cedar was considered to be the finest of woods in that day. The cedars of Lebanon were famous for their quality and their durability. And so most of the temple was built by Solomon with this wood he got from Lebanon. And so when this makes reference to the beams of our house being cedar, the only house you're going to find in Jerusalem that has cedar wood in it is the temple itself. And so what I hear is the man saying, as we begin this relationship together, we're going to make a family that is built, as it were, in God's house. This is going to be a relationship that has God in the middle of it. That's not a secondary issue. There's a reason the Old Testament makes such a big deal about intermarrying with foreigners. There's a reason Abraham didn't want Isaac to marry someone from one of those neighboring tribes. Because the tendency was for these foreigners to worship other gods. And so when the Israelites would marry these foreigners, the tendency was for them to seduce the Israelites into not, they wouldn't stop worshiping Jehovah, but they'd also worship these other gods, and they would divide their hearts. They'd divide their faith. In fact, that was Solomon's big problem. Can read about him in 1 Kings 11. The more wives he acquired, the more he tended to chase after these gods that his wives brought into his household. So by the end of his life, the Bible says about Solomon, his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. And the Bible lays the blame for that squarely at the number of wives he married who didn't believe in God. The New Testament puts it like this. It says, do not be yoked together with unbelievers. For what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? What fellowship can light have with darkness? It's a verse that applies to more than marriage, but it's certainly applicable to marriage. When a farmer puts a pair of oxen in the yoke, he wants them to be evenly matched. If one is large and strong, the other is smaller and weaker, the tendency is for them to pull against each other. They don't pull in harmony. They don't pull in the same direction. They fight against each other in the yoke. In the same way, a marriage between a Christ follower and a non-believer is bound to have difficulties. Faith is going to become a source of conflict. Either the one following Christ is going to feel him or herself pulled away from faith, or the believing spouse is going to end up in a position of always praying and waiting for the other to come to belief. Now, I know this is a tough issue. I know for some of you, this cuts right to the heart. Some of you find yourselves in marriages where you and your spouse do not see eye to eye on matters of faith. Tell you, my heart breaks for you. I can only imagine how hard that is to be praying daily for your spouse. I have a friend, Matt Mitchell. I've mentioned him before. He's a pastor in Pennsylvania. He also writes a blog. For the last 12 years or so, he's been writing a blog he calls Hot Orthodoxy, and he posts his weekly sermons on there as well as other things. And one of the features of his blog is that it tracks the most popular posts. It tracks the things that people click on most. And about 8 years ago, he wrote and posted a sermon called Married to an Unbeliever. And ever since he put that up there, it's been the most popular, the most clicked on thing on his blog for 8 consecutive years. So I get that for folks who are in this situation, you're looking for help. You're struggling. And this sermon isn't really about that. I can't really get into, you know, advice. There is biblical advice about this. 1 Peter chapter 3 talks about it. So I'll just refer you to Matt's website. I put it up here. It's www.matt.mitchell.blogspot.com. And there's a little window called Popular Posts. It's just right on the right side. And if you scroll down and you find it and you click on it, I think if this is something that you're wondering about and you're looking for help here, I think this is, you'll find a lot of grace here and a lot of truth. But my point today is that if you are considering what's important and who you're attracted to, don't forget about the spiritual. You know, they say if you're at a dinner party, the two things you should never talk about are religion and politics. I think a lot of people kind of apply that to dating too. No, we can't talk about religion. I mean, good grief. We start talking about religion, the relationship might end. I tell you, if you are a Christ follower, how can you not talk about this thing that's really one of the most important things there is to know about you? Jesus wants to be first in your heart. He wants to be the treasure that you would trade in everything else to possess. So if you willfully and knowingly enter into a relationship with someone who doesn't view Jesus in the same way, I warn you, there's going to be conflict. So we're doing a series on marriage. And it starts with the desire. What should you be attracted to in a potential mate? Or if you are married, what are those things that you need to remind yourself of that brought you together in the first place? Attraction comes in three tiers. There's the physical. Do you like the way he or she looks? Do you find him or her to be charming? This is a legitimate level of attraction. But there's more. There's the moral. Is he or she a good person? Does he have integrity? Does she have a servant's heart? Character matters. And then there's the spiritual. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, then you have to know, is that other person a believer as well? It's not a secondary matter. It's a matter of first importance. And finally, let me end like this. As strange and mysterious as the Song of Songs is, most every commentator agrees that it also functions as a pointer to Jesus Christ. That is to say, the love expressed between the lover and the beloved in this poem is also considered to be a foreshadowing of the love that Jesus has for His bride, the church. So you can read a verse like Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 4. It says, He's taken me to His banqueting hall, and His banner over me is love. And you can read that as it is, as a kind of a statement of the marriage between the lover and the beloved. Because that's what it is. This is when the two come together and they celebrate their marriage. So you can read it that way, but you can also read this as something that we as Christians can say about Jesus. Jesus takes us to His banqueting hall. The banner Jesus hangs above us is love. So what I want to say is that as you're listening to this sermon, you're seeing some of the mistakes that you've made. You're being reminded of a relationship where you let it get too physical. Or maybe you're thinking about that character flaw you knew that was there with your spouse, but you thought it would go away. Or maybe you find yourself in a spiritually uneven, an unequally yoked marriage. Here's what I want to say. His banner over you is love. His banner over you is love. In other words, there's grace. There's grace for past mistakes. There's hope for your future. Maybe things aren't the way they should be in your relationship today. Maybe there are broken pieces, but I believe Jesus is saying to you today, let me in. Give those broken pieces to me. Let me show you what I can do. Jesus says, my banner over you is love. And maybe this series on marriage, maybe this is just what your marriage needs to give you an opportunity to let Jesus in and start putting some of those broken pieces back together.